So it is, the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
In your heart, you know he's right.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
This is Liberty in Exile with your host, Yael Osofsky.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bring you liberty, not destroy it. The evil the government's duel is after them. The good is often tear to their bones. So let it be and let it rest with liberty in exile. Hello and welcome to the program. I am your host, Yael Osofsky, reporting to you from the Sovereign Southern Studio here in the beautiful Confederate South. It is a great and wonderful day, the 11th of August, 2012. It is a new month in the dwindling year that shall be a political minefield. I am joined on this program. It will be our second guest ever on Liberty in Exile. The first one was about a year and a half ago on CJLO on the airwaves. Now we're broadcasting out, and I have my good friend Christopher Redfield on the line. He's a good, smart, intelligent man. I would say, philosophical in his standards in the way that he views the world. So, Sir Christopher, welcome to the program. How's it feel? I know you're there.
Hey, Yael. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right, great.
Feels great.
Super. All right, so I guess we can begin. You know, we got a little Google Doc open of stuff to talk about, to look at. But the most important thing is that we are just here to have fun, to parse through the news, the events, everything that's going on that is wrong with the world or right. So I guess I'll throw it to you first off. I guess we both turned on the television this morning and had the unfortunate, circumstance of having CNN people in my face telling me about our brand new vice presidential candidate, Paul Ryan from Wisconsin. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a tragedy, of course. Paul Ryan is your standard GOP conservative. I think that he is a bit more radical. At least that's what the left wants us to believe, right? He wants us to believe that Paul Ryan wants to cut government to nothing. And Paul Ryan does pay lip service to folks such as Hayek. And he even name drops Ayn Rand from time to time. But at the end of the day, when you look at his record, when you look at the things that he supported, when you look at his other rhetoric, he is a standard GOPer.
I think most people would understand that, at least for me and probably for you. Of course, we're not at all going to be tempted to vote for that ticket at all in any way. However, I think it's interesting. I mean, to say that this guy is a disappointment, a disaster, I wouldn't say so. I mean, it is a disastrous ticket, first off. But, I mean, the guy is someone who, he has not propelled his career by saying, let's bomb Iran. That's the only thing.
I agree.
But, however, I was watching Fox News this morning, and again, watching these big tubby guys who are commentators. A couple of these guys were just like, or also Eric Cantor called in one of these shows, and he was like, you know, we need to make sure that what's important is important, guard America's national security and making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. And, of course, this guy is an official campaign surrogate who was given the talking points, you know, tattooed on his arm. So that is probably going to be the attitude going forward. So with that in mind, I'd probably say, yeah, that'd be a huge disappointment.
You know, I will agree, and when you think more about it, given at least the rhetoric that Paul Ryan pays to fiscal conservatism or towards cutting government spending, it is a shift away from the McCain-Palin sort of ticket.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think that's what a lot of people are saying. He's the, quote, anti-Palin choice. What a stupid thing. Huh. Hey, what's this picture you sent me? What is this? Adam versus the man, talking about Paul Ryan, voted for TARP, auto bailouts, Medicare, housing subsidies, National ID card, Patriot Act, surveillance without a warrant, no child left behind, keeping troops in Iraq, and both stimuli. No, 2008, 2009.
Yeah, so that's something that Adam the man posted. I don't really follow Adam Kokesh. However, I mean, if this is the case, this is a tragic voting record.
Tragic voting record. Yeah. No, I guess you're right. That's the whole thing is what I was sort of looking at, and what would be interesting is if you just had like a no, like again, I hate Republicans. I really do. Not a fan of them at all. The only time I've ever voted anything Republican was registered to vote for Ron Paul. You can put that down on the record. But I think if, you know, Ronnie really wanted to do something interesting and not play the same political game, he would have just, like, picked some huge CEO dude. That's what I would have done.
I don't know. I think – so if, this is a really tough – if we're gonna Sunday morning quarterback for Mitt Romney and for his VP pick, and he want – like, it depends on what's the goal. If the goal is to win – that's never going to happen.
No, I'm talking about our freedoms.
So
you mad right now?
I think that the only thing that he could have done, honestly, is maybe put someone on the ticket like a Rand Paul, because he's a viable VP candidate, and yeah. It would have put those in the libertarian camp in a tough spot whether or not they want to vote for him. Because obviously there's going to be a lot of libertarians voting for the libertarian candidate. They're going to abandon the GOP because of the way that the GOP treated Ron Paul, and they lost that vote. But if they wanted to really try and go after it, they could put someone on the ticket like Rand Paul.
Okay. Well, I think now you've sort of opened me up, and we'll throw down the stupid game of playing quarterbacking for the Mitt Romney pick there, as you're talking about. And you brought up Rand Paul, and this week I posted a video, or I guess I didn't post it. It was Rand Paul posted on the YouTube page about Fahrenheit 451. And you put some comments on it, so I just wanted to play it, and we'll get some take on it. Is that cool?
Sounds good.
Off we go. So this is Rand Paul. He's speaking at Freedom Fest in Las Vegas. I was actually invited, but I didn't want to go out there. Too bad. So this is him speaking to the crowd. Off we go.
In the opening pages of Fahrenheit 451, Guy Montag asks, "Wasn't there a time when firemen used to put out fires?" They laugh at him and they rebuke him and say, "Everybody knows firemen start fires." Now, Montag knew this. Montag's father and his grandfather had been firemen. It had been his duty for many years to start fires. He knew it was his duty to burn books. But this day was a little bit different. He showed up and the woman wouldn't leave. He said, "The woman's on the porch. She won't leave. She has all of her books and she won't leave." So as they're dousing her books and her with kerosene, she shouts out and she goads them. She is indignant that they would touch her books at all. And she won't leave. And she says, "Play the man, Master Ridley. Today we will light such a candle by God's grace in England that it won't be forgotten." They keep dousing her with kerosene and she says it again. "Play the man, Master Ridley. Today we will light such a candle." And the reference is lost on the firemen in the book, and they continue to do their job. The reference is to Hugh Latimer, who became a human candle. He was burned at the stake in 1555 for heresy. His heresy was to oppose the state religion. His heresy was to oppose the state. His heresy was to promote that the Bible
do not
be
oppose
translated
the state.
Into English. Now, we're not yet burning folks at the stake, fortunately.
Yeah, we are.
We're not burning books, but your government is interested in what books you read.
Yeah.
They're interested in what you say on your phone calls. They're interested in what you write in your emails. This has been going on for a while now. Last week, I asked for a report on this, and I was given a classified briefing. I wanted to know, to what extent is your privacy being invaded? To what extent are they reading your emails, reading and listening to your phone conversations without a judge's warrant? And I can't tell you the answer because it's classified.
Classified.
It's classified how many times they're doing it. But I think what I can get away with saying is that when the government says it's a few hundred, it's closer to a gazillion. All right? And a gazillion's a fictitious number, but it's a very large number, and that is close to the number of communications that are being looked at by the federal government. We are giving up our privacy. We are trading our liberty for some sort of sense or some sort of ostensible security.
Okay, this went too long, but I don't know. We get the point. I actually, interestingly enough, I was on my way home driving up to North Carolina, and I plugged in Fahrenheit 451 on the audiobook. And it was actually the original Ray Bradbury version. A friend of mine recommended it, and it was amazing. I think I talked about this a couple of times. These are the kind of books that are, you know, the so-called American classics in the canon. The ones that are sort of shoved down your throat when you're, you know, 11, 12 years old, when nobody understands the true significance of it.
And right.
I think maybe the people in public education are smarter than I think, but maybe they give us these books when we're young. They plant the seed, and then when we're older, the point is we reread the books and we actually understand what's going on. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that, well, given the leftist tendency at university, I don't really see that being very different in the public school system. And these books take a leftist perspective, which is, you know, be skeptical of government. And yeah. I think that's where this where these book picks come from.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was required to read Fahrenheit 451. I was required to read Animal Farm. And I mean, these books have a similar theme.
Yeah, that's true. And it's so weird that we're inundated with that when we're, you know, 11, 12 years old. We have no clue. I mean, we can't understand that. We don't know the intricacies of government and empire. And yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I agree.
So, what is your opinion of Rand Paul? You think he's like? You know, a lot of people say, as far as libertarian or the classical liberal movement, if I can use that term, that all of a sudden, just at some point in his career, he'll just like turn around and become a Ron Paul figure. He'll start actually advocating for ending the empire or for coming out and, you know, auditing the Federal Reserve or ending it outright. What do you think?
I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah.
I think he's playing his cards to an extent, but he's also being sincere.
Okay. That's true. I mean, I remember when he was running for Senate, and you had one of his first ads that came out talking about how he was, quote, strong on national defense, and it showed a picture of a jet. And there were everybody on websites and the internet, they just went crazy. They were just like, it's all over. He's been co-opted.
Right, right. There's a bit of overreaction on the internet in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, what else do people on the internet have to do but, you know, sit around and goof off?
Right, and make sensationalist headlines.
Very true. Well, believe me, man, I worked in the newspaper industry, and that's all they try to do. Like, they have copy editors who will sit down at the end of the day and just, like, how can we get the most eyeballs on this one?
Right.
And most of the time, it's, you know, it's pretty terrible stuff. Sometimes they get some funny ones, though. They're pretty good, and sometimes it's, yeah, good things. So I guess we'll transition on from Rand Paul and the Paul Ryan and the VP talk, and I guess the point of Rand Paul's speech was more about government privacy and government secrecy. And for me, this is like a lasting crusade. And I think arguing with people on what you could call the other side, to tell you the truth, I see most conservatives as the people that I'm most opposed to at the end of the day. And I know we've, I think we've talked about this before, in that you have sort of this view of government in general. So those who you would call collectivist, progressives, those on the left, whatever it may be, they believe that government can do good, and it does good generally. However, conservatives believe that government can only do good if the right people are in charge. That's the way that I see it, at least.
So if the question is, which side do libertarians or those who value liberty have to fear more? I think that's a really difficult question. But to the very last thing that you said, which is that conservatives think that government can do well if the right people are in, I think that is a view that is shared by both sides. Both sides think that if the right people are in, government can do well.
No, but I understand that point. But their point is that it's not necessarily the whoever's in charge or who's leading it. It's more about the institutions that matter. And I hate to use that phraseology, because we all know what that means. Institutions matter. Whose thesis that is. But my whole point is that for them, it's not as if nobody's saying that, oh, because if Romney's in government, everything tomorrow will change. They still believe that the programs that they believe a lot of people rely on will still be there. I mean, just because you have a Republican in there, I think the institutions, for this, they say, I mean, the way that Republicans have framed it is just, if we get Mitt Romney in tomorrow, everything's okay, which is exactly what they said with Obama. But nothing changed. It was exactly the same view. And, of course, they all have their manipulated, you know, herders that are bringing them along and, you know, vote this or that way or think this way. I don't know. It just bothers me at the end of the day. And I find I have more problems dealing with conservative types whenever I'm talking about issues such as security or talking about Patriot Act or wars in general and invasion and empire. I get way more pushback from them than I do from so-called progressives, liberals, whatever they may call it.
Yeah, I guess that it's probably the case that you focus on different issues than I do, because I find myself disagreeing with the left far more often, but it's because of their attack on kind of like sound economic principles. So if you're worried about government spying on you and that kind of thing, there are ways to get around that technologically. And the more wealthy we are, which comes from good economic principles, the more wealthy we are, the better we'll be able to get around those kind of government tactics. So I don't necessarily see that as the worst of things. It is bad, and government shouldn't be doing these things, obviously. But the attack on that which makes us wealthy is the worst.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't think it's prevailing, and I think I've talked about this before. We're living in sort of a fractal, right? So we're living in the Great Depression circa 1935, about right now, where you had huge attacks on capital, on private investment. You had huge swarms of populist mobs saying, tax the rich, tax the rich.
Eat the rich.
Yeah, eat the rich. Tax them, impose tariffs so to get rid of all these foreigners who are trying to sell us stuff. I mean, it is a hugely – it's dangerous. And the argument really can be made that that worsened the Depression, you know, 20 times what it normally would have been had they just sort of let it slide. I don't know. It's a – I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, you need to go back to essential core principles. But as I would, as I've heard often, you need to choose a side, man. You need to pick a side.
Yeah, so, haven't you picked a side?
Yeah, no. I don't think I've ever picked a side with anything. Yeah, that's all good. That's it, goes. So you got a couple links here that you've thrown into the doc. Which one you want to tackle first? What do you want to look at?
Well, we can start with some good news. Well, right. I have two things of good news. The first will be something that already happened. And then we can talk about something that could be happening in the future, hopefully will be happening. And so the first is that the Institute for Justice, which is a non-for-profit law practice kind of, they were able to help this woman from Utah be able to practice her hair braiding without getting a license from the state. And whole argument behind why licensing was necessary is kind of for, you know, the public safety. And what the Institute for Justice showed was that there were multiple states around the country where they didn't have this licensing necessary or the amount of training for the licensing necessary. And we didn't see any kind of negative public effects. So there's no increased amount of deaths from unlicensed cosmetologists or injuries. So that's the argument. The safety issue is the argument from the cosmetologists themselves. However, the economic argument is that the cosmetologists that were already entrenched, these salons and schools that already had established their programs and their businesses, they want to keep out competition. So what they do is they tell the government, hey, let's raise these licensing fees, let's raise these hours necessary to get a license, and that way they keep out hair braiders or any other person that wants to practice cosmetology entering their market, competing with them, and lowering prices.
Yeah.
So no. The incentives are there to shut these smaller competitors out of the market. And the Institute for Justice recognized this, not only saw that it was unjust, but that it has bad economic consequences and hurts the consumer, and they fought and they won in this case.
Okay. Yeah, no, I listened to a Planet Money podcast on NPR, and I remember them advertising about, or not advertising, they covered this story not that long ago, about 2 months ago, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Just about, it's just like this woman who learned this type of African braiding that she thought was awesome. A lot of people in the community thought it was awesome. She started her own little business. She would go around hair braiding. She put it up on Craigslist, and then some guy emailed and was like, hey, it's illegal to do this in Utah without a license. Delete your ad now. And it just sort of went on from there. I don't know. I guess you could say, as you said before, it's a victory. That's exactly true.
Yeah, it's a victory. To go on with what happened in that story is that the woman, I don't know if she's an immigrant, but she couldn't believe that in America she needed a license in order to do the hair braiding that she was doing. So she went to the city, or she went to the state, and she figured, and they let her know that it was indeed the case that she needed a license. And instead of operating in the black market, which I'm sure she could have done, she ended up trying to fight it, and she sought out the Institute for Justice, and they won the case together.
Cool. Well, there we go. There's a victory out in Mormon country.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, we'll get a lot more Mormon stuff in the news, like in the next few months. Be interesting. I don't know if you're interested in that.
Are you saying that we're going to get more Mormon stuff in the news because of Mitt Romney presidency?
Yeah, definitely.
Or candidacy?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Interesting. I think whenever religion is brought into the public discourse, to me it's hilarious.
There's always a high entertainment value, I think.
I don't know. For me, it's a fun thing. But that's not our main subject. Let's sort of go on. I think we got some clips. Well, you got us on, you know, one victory, one our high horse. You got another victory for us?
Yeah, so another victory for the private sector, if you will, is that a private passenger rail service from Orlando to Miami is going to start construction in 2014. So I guess they must have cleared all their permits, all their permission with government, and all of their like, their business plan must be sound, or at least sound enough that they think they should go forward with it. So that's supposedly going to be starting in 2014. Construction should be starting soon. And for the people that say that it's only the government that can create infrastructure, it's only the government that is willing to take these kind of risks on these huge projects, that's simply not the case.
Definitely. And I actually posted this story on their website I run, Florida Watchdog, and everyone there, for some reason, because they're so brainwashed, and because the slaves are so, I guess, conditioned, they assumed right away that this was like Amtrak 2.0 and the government was funding it. I don't understand. I think people now, in their minds, have a view that trains are just run by the government. That's how long we've been conditioned. That even if there's a private project put forth, people are still associate that. And I don't know, will it... the way I was thinking about this story is that right now, from the way it seems, it's going to be a huge line set up. You know, you're going to have Orlando to Miami. A lot of people make that trip, you know, made it plenty of times. The thing is, though, is if they have the private investment now, does this them therefore give them the power to go to the government and say, look, we have all these private sources, but we need to make it bigger. Let's go up to Jacksonville. You know, give us $1 billion subsidies and we'll do that.
No, I think that it certainly gives them a bargaining position to do something like that. I think that's definitely the case. Mm-hmm. Not that that's necessarily their intention.
The only reason I say that... Yeah.
Go ahead.
The only reason I say that, though, is because at one point in the article, they say that the guy who... Cumber. Who's this Cumber guy? He was in Cumber. He's vice president of the corporate development at Florida East Coast Line Railway, which, by the way, sounds like it's a made-up dummy corporation started 2 years ago. Let's see here. Now it says it operates 351 miles mainland track along the East Coast. Okay. No, that's right. Anyway, at one point in the article, he's speaking to the Beacon Council. Now, the Beacon Council in Miami-Dade County is the big group that does what we would call economic development. You know, that unsure term where you have basically an agency set up, private industry set up, little corporate, I guess, roundtable that is used to divert taxpayer dollars to certain industries as a way of, quote, creating jobs or anything. It's really a huge scam. Imagine Chamber of Commerce, but they have, like, direct access to taxpayer funds.
Right.
It's, you know, crony capitalism, Inc. I mean, that's basically what it is.
I think that's a great analysis. That sounds exactly what it is.
And I think that's the only thing in the article that sort of, I guess, alludes to the fact that perhaps he was maybe, I don't know, begging for public funds. The way it makes it seem like it, he seems like it'd be profitable. And if that's true, awesome. And if that's true, let's get him all over Florida, man. It sucks driving all the time.
Yeah, I agree.
And of course, I'm a big proponent. I, you know, having lived in Montreal and in Europe, I kind of like mass transit. I think it's awesome. If you can have a private system, 100 times better.
No, I dig it. I dig it as well. I don't know who it was from the Mises Institute who was arguing this, but their position was basically that in a stateless society or in a society where roads weren't subsidized, there would be a lot fewer roads and there would be a lot more systems of mass transit.
Yeah.
I mean, we can even kind of look at this in history. I did a little bit of research when I found out about the article, and that's the amount of private trains that were in existence and running in America's early history. And also realize that this is a time when trains were much more expensive endeavors, relatively speaking, than they are now. So there was a transcontinental that was built privately and run privately. There were trains in Vermont and where is this other city? And then Chicago as well, or in Illinois, all over Illinois. So there were private trains throughout America's history.
You know what? You know what this might be, though? Now that I'm thinking about it, this could totally be some sort of promotional thing, publicity stunt. And we all know publicity stunts. Everyone just go to your local Chick-fil-A and see the lines backed up. But I think this could be, and think with me here, publicity stunt for Atlas Shrugged Part 2. Movie comes out October 12th. What do you think?
You know, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility, anything for a publicity stunt. But perhaps they would have named it differently.
I know, right? They named it the John Galt line or something like that. Then
exactly.
Then it would have been just clear. It is true, though. I mean, it is Atlas Shrugged. And I saw a Cato posting on Facebook, I think a few months ago, after that whole Obama thing where he said, "You didn't build that."
Right.
Actually, let me find that clip. Because I don't think I played that here. "You didn't build that? You got a business?
If you've been successful, you didn't get there on your own. You didn't get there on your own. I'm always struck by people who think, well, it must be because I was just so smart. There are a lot of smart people out there. It must be because I worked harder than everybody else. Let me tell you something. There are a whole bunch of hardworking people out there."
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
"If you were successful, somebody along the line gave you some help. There was a great teacher somewhere in your life. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we had that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen. The internet didn't get invented on its own."
Yeah, it did. Al Gore. Oh, man. So that's, and then I saw the Cato posting just talking about, you know, Hank Reardon, and everyone's, basically the point of the book is just everyone starts clamoring and the people start taking it over for the good of society. And of course, Obama had to go out and put out another ad.
"Those ads, taking my words about small business out of context, they're flat out wrong. Of course Americans build their own businesses.
Damage control."
Oh, man, that's so sad.
I know.
I feel kind of bad for him having to come out and say that.
I know. I mean, it's a pretty good ad, though. Good quality. They threw it together in probably something like less than 24 hours. I'm impressed.
That's interesting because I didn't even hear about it until
really?
Just now.
Let's hear it.
"Hardworking people sacrifice to meet a payroll, create jobs, and make our economy run. And what I said was that we need to stand behind them, as America always
did." No, you didn't.
"Yes. By investing in education and training, roads and bridges, research and technology. I'm Barack Obama, and I prove this message because I believe we're all in this together."
Oh, there's the selling point. We're all in this together, man.
Yeah, I mean, he's just parroting Elizabeth Warren's talking point where it's government that's necessary to create the infrastructure. And this is an example, like this private train system that's on the way isn't an example of government infrastructure. So it's an example of private infrastructure. And one of my favorite examples that came out in the news recently is the drug tunnels underneath the Mexican border.
Ooh.
So there are multiple of these. Some of these have rail systems. And this is an example where not only are people not using government-created roads to transport their goods, but they're creating their own, and they're doing it in secret. So they have all of the cards stacked against them, the entire deck, not only one deck. It's like the size of the deck that the blackjack dealer has. So that's like 10 decks at a time. They're all stacked against them, and they're still creating the infrastructure necessary to bring their goods to market.
Hmm. That's awesome. Here, I got a little clip from Al Jazeera, I think.
U.S. and Mexican authorities say troops have seized more than 32 tons of marijuana
after
finding a drug smuggling tunnel linking the two countries. The 550-meter tunnel stretches between Tijuana and San Diego. It was equipped with electric rail cars. The discovery comes 2 weeks after authorities found another smuggling tunnel connecting the two cities.
Dude, that is half a kilometer. That is awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing.
Well, what if they're
what libertarians should be doing in this case is celebrating the ingenuity, the engineering feat, and just the existence of this private infrastructure. And I just don't think a lot of people recognize that that's what it is.
And also, I've actually caught a lot of flack for praising drug dealers. I think drug dealers are awesome. The only reason I say that is
entrepreneurs.
Yeah, no, they're entrepreneurs, and not just entrepreneurs that have to face the ravishes of the market and competition, but they have to face law enforcement. They have to face the system.
They have to face the full wrath of the state.
Exactly, and I think for me, you know, it's sort of also undocumented immigrants who go out there and put their labor out on the market and live day in and day out on cash only. These guys are heroes.
I couldn't agree more.
They are heroes, and you know I've been.
What a tragedy that not only do they have to face all of this, but they have to face the social stigma and this idea that they're stealing jobs, that they're criminal. Not only are they criminal for simply crossing the border and working, but they're criminal in a social sense for stealing jobs. It's tragic. It's tragic because they're heroes, and they're receiving it's not as if they're being ignored. It's that they're facing the complete opposite treatment. They're facing the treatment of an enemy or someone evil.
Mm. Definitely, man. Wow. I think that's something that is not often talked about, is because, you know, people always, I remember growing up, right? What is the number one stigma of drug use growing up? It's not, oh, you know, it's illegal, man. It's illegal. I don't know. It's illegal. It has nothing to do with the health benefits. People don't care. They don't care about this or that. I mean, that's the whole thing with alcohol. You know, when you're 16, 17, 18 years old, everybody's trying to do everything they can to acquire that. And you've created that incentive. You've pumped it up to make it more desirable than really, at the end of the day, it really is. I mean, is it really worth it for me to be able to go to my fridge and pop open a beer? No, not at all. But victory, I love the tunnel. I got to get me one of those installed. I think that's awesome. That's a good one. That's cool. Man, this is a very positive mood podcast. I'm used to talking about being shut down all the time and things not going our way and...
Yeah, man, you should have me on more often.
Yeah, I know. Positive. Positive. Okay, so I guess what's some other clips we can play here? Other things to look at. I have one. I don't know. You want to get into finance? I know you're a big economics guy.
I do love the economy. But there's one thing that I've been kind of arguing lately or talking about engaging with some people on the left. And that is about... Hold on, I think it just disappeared from me.
No, I just moved it.
Okay. And that is the parallels that I see between the left and objectivism. And I'm not an objectivist, but I know that
just for people listening, what would being an objectivist mean? What does that mean?
So the easy way is just someone that follows the philosophy of Ayn Rand or believes in it or believes that it's true or it has some truth value. And that in a nutshell, I mean, it's not something that's easy to say in a sentence, but the short of it is that there are objective values and Ayn Rand knows them. So she knows what they are, and
okay, so you're making out to be like it is a Ayn Rand personality cult, basically. Right?
It is.
But at the end of the day, if I were because I, you know, I've read a few of the novels and I've seen it, and to me it seems like it really is in embracing selfishness, I think is how I would put down objectivism. I understand that you can go back to the whole part of philosophy. The way that I see it is just the virtue of selfishness, as one of her essays, I think, is called.
Right. So my short criticism of Rand is that she gets things backwards. So it's not the selfishness that creates this, you know, harmonious society. It's the institutions that are placed in front of our human nature. So our human nature is selfish in a lot of ways. But if we structure institutions in the right way to channel our human nature, then we can come out with a harmonious society. Okay. So that's my short criticism of Rand. So she sees things backwards, I think, whereas it's the combination of the institutions that allows for our nature to have a good outcome.
And then at the end of the day, it's also just, you know, are people ordered by self-interest? Is that really what motivates people to build societies and buildings and families and make money or give money to the poor? Is it all about self-interest at the end of the day? That's really been my argument for objectivism. The way that I've seen a lot of people criticize it, and you started out with this, but at the end you gave the criticism of the ideas, is just to say, oh, well, you know, she has this view, and the way I've seen it is, I don't know anything about Ayn Rand at all. I don't really care. I just read the novels, and I get a summary in my head, and I apply that to things in my life. I think the greatest thing I saw, I did see an interview, though, with her. She did with, what's his name there, Joker, Phil Donahue. And in that, she starts talking about loving someone is very selfish. You know, and at the core, you're like, what? That can't be true. You know, what is that? But when you think about it, you love another person, right? You do that not just because of how, you know, how it makes them feel, but you do it for how it makes you feel. It makes you more secure. It makes you feel like you have a connection with another person. You don't necessarily care. You're not doing it for the other person, I guess you can sort of say, which at the core sounds extremely heartless in our society, right?
It does.
But I think it's definitely true.
But I think it's true as well. And we can kind of see this in divorce rates, right? Because if it were the case that you loved someone for their sake, then we would never see instances of divorce, right? Because there'd be no reason to leave a marriage even if you were unhappy, because it's not your happiness that's what's keeping you together.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, I got you off track there. Talk to me about objective value and labor theory, because messing around with this, I used to be an expert in this stuff, and I've just become disconnected. As you can tell, I'm so, I guess I would say, inundated with news day in and day out that I get lost from the broader principles at stake. And that's why I have you there, man. You are my philosophical backbone.
Man, we'll complement each other. All right. So first, before I get into labor theory, I want to draw the parallel between something that I've seen recently. A video came out, some kind of connection with Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Wall Street's first anniversary, which is going to be September 17th. It's almost been a year since they started.
Party
time, yeah, definitely. And
okay,
hold on.
For those who don't know, Christopher Redfield is a huge member of the Occupy community, and he has been very involved, and he's actually been trying to teach these peeps some economics. He's held some economics courses. That's awesome, man. You're fighting on the front lines, and I think for a lot of people, that could be seen as courageous. But I think you've sort of evolved and learned and has sort of broken down and deconstructed the core arguments from inside the camps. I think that's awesome.
Thanks. I really appreciate that. Yeah, something that I've been trying hard to do is really understand what is driving the attitudes and the mass movements that we see out of Occupy. And this is how I know about this this video that I'm about to show. Actually, do you want to pull it up?
Yeah, I got it right here. We'll cue it. It's called Communique Number One.
From the debtor's jungle, we are the invisible army of defaulters. We are your neighbors, we are your family, your friends. We are millions, we are everywhere. We are going to bring the system to its knees. We can, because we wield the one power that all the armies of the world can never defeat, the power of refusal. This power has destroyed the mightiest empires. The same fate awaits the current system of mafia capitalism in America. An economic system driven by Wall Street CEOs who produce nothing, contribute nothing, who have bought our government and reduced it into a criminal enterprise whose main purpose is to support loan sharking, gambling, extortion, and the slow reduction of American citizens into debt peons. Every dollar we take from a subprime mortgage speculator, every dollar we save from a collection agency, is a tiny piece of our own lives and freedom that we can give back to our communities. To be able to take care of our children, our friends, our families, is a value that no accountant can ever measure, that no government loan administrator or hedge fund manager can ever have the right to take away from us. We are an army of lovers who cannot be defeated. We are laying the groundwork for another world. Strike debt.
Okay, so interesting clip, and if you see the video, you see a lot
of...
I yield 1 minute to Christopher Redfield. Tell us about that video.
Right, so, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric in there, and we can look at their term of mafia capitalism, or we can look at their criticism of CEOs and Wall Street in general. But what I'm kind of interested in from this is that they are exhibiting the same attitude as that which is promoted in Rand's Atlas Shrugged, right? So Rand kind of maybe challenges that those who are productive in society should go on strike and then let society see where it finds itself. In this video, The people who are promoting the idea are saying that we should stop upholding our part of the bargain. We should stop paying back the debt. So what they call themselves is the invisible army of defaulters. And I just see a similar attitude between these two ideas, which is kind of a withdrawal from, quote, the system. We want to get out of the system. We want to withdraw in some way. So I just saw that. I saw that parallel, and I think it's ironic because of the hatred that each camp has for each other.
Hmm. That's interesting, and I think it brings up a good point. And I've worked, and I think you know it's very similar for you. I've worked in a very hierarchical environment before. I worked at Home Depot. Oh, great. But this is a place where there is a hierarchy, and it is bashed upon your head day in and day out. And I feel like I'm Noam Chomsky right now. But when you're at that bottom level, you know, when you're a sales joker, you know, talking to people about barbecues or whatever, you're at the bottom, and then you see your managers who, the way it seems to you, and I think Occupy, they have a point, I guess you can say, is that the people above you, they're not necessarily working as hard. They're, you know, I hate to use those terms. They don't perform the same function. And then the people above them, it's even worse. And then normally, two or three steps above that person, it's total administration. People who've never walked into a Home Depot don't even know what products we're selling. Then you go to the very top, and what do CEOs actually do? I guess they provide leadership. They have quote-unquote visions.
Right, so maybe a good popular pop culture example is the idea of Christian Bale's character in American Psycho, right?
Okay.
What's his name?
Patrick Bateman.
Patrick Bateman. Patrick Bateman is the epitome of non-production, right? He sits in his father's office and does nothing all day. So this is the kind of idea that people have of these higher ups in companies, and I can't necessarily comment on it because I'm not embedded in that kind of culture. I don't know if that's the case. From the leadership that I do see in firms of which I'm familiar, leadership works extremely hard. You're right, not in the same way as those lower on the totem pole. But everyone is gunning for their position. So whether that work is devoted towards fending them off, whether it be through some kind of office politics or whether it be through showing productive effort and showing results, they're working in their own way to maintain their position. And because their position is more sought after, they have to work hard. Like, they have to work harder at that.
You like Huey Lewis on the news?
Sorry, I had to do that.
Do it.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And being at that part of the ladder at the very bottom, that's sort of the way you see it. But I guess I would sort of go in is does it have objective value? Can you say, well, this guy, the CEO, he's not tightening, you know, bolts or lug nuts all day. Obviously, he's not doing anything. It requires a different part of your person. It requires your mind, your leadership, your ideas, innovation. I guess it all plugs into the conversation that the country has as a whole right now in the nation. If you ever can even think of whatever the nation is, I guess I would say right. The national news media. I think that's better. In the media, they're just talking about what is productive. You know, what is, if you're in, for example, venture capitalism, that is very productive. But if you're talking about the other side of it, what's that called?
Vulture capitalism?
No. That predatory is, no, hold on. I know the term. There's a good podcast on, I think it was Cato or something that talked about that. So venture capitalism is awesome. That's what, you know, got Facebook pumped up, PayPal, all these huge internet companies. Okay. But then you have brokerage firms and all this stuff that Mitt Romney did where you go in and take over companies that are failing and do all that. So it's just about what is productive, you know, what is wealth at the end of the day, right? I think we've created it, and I want to transition to talking about Ron Paul a lot more right now, just because we don't have much more time to be talking about Ron Paul doing stuff in Congress. And it brings up a point that he's sort of talked about, is that the last probably decade has not been real growth at all. It's been people who've been shuffling around money left and right, but there hasn't been any actual growth in employment, nor in GDP, as people have pointed out. And I think it's always useful to look at as we were discussing earlier, the Federal Reserve. So lead us into a little conversation here about the Fed and what's going on lately. You got this.
Oh, you're asking me?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah.
Clip. I'm sorry
about
that.
I'm asking you.
So Ron Paul, I do agree. We're not going to be talking about him for very much longer. Recently, he just commented on Elizabeth Warren's famous clip that Obama was kind of parroting, and I mean he's a libertarian through and through. He made all the talking points, and I mean, his position, I think, is solidified in history. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to talk about his happenings in Congress for very much longer. But as far as the economy goes, I think measuring real growth is problematic, and it's very difficult to do. I know that in the last 10 years, all of our internet experience has improved dramatically. Our technology has improved dramatically. I was just at the mall yesterday. It's not something that I usually go to, but you can hook up your iPhone to a projector and start projecting immediately. Like you just hook it right up into a little it looks like a phone case almost, and you can project onto a wall. So it's similar to like this Star Trek idea of projecting holograms,
holograms. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, holograms. Like, so you see someone else talking, and that's here. So I was pretty amazed at that, and I think that these are things that improve lives, and in that way we can look at them as growth. But as far as GDP figures go, and the amount of dollars that have been pumped into the economy by the banking sector, Federal Reserve included. When you add that in addition to all the losses, especially all the dead weight loss that has happened from the housing boom and the housing crash, it's really tough to say. It's tough to say whether there's been.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I understand your point, is that we have so much more wealth, of course, in our society, more technology, more people than ever own fridges and computers and drive cars and. That I understand. I just mean, on a whole, if you look at net, as far as production, and I mean, the ideas that led to the internet and technology and all that, the huge run-up has not been in the last 10 years alone. It's been 20 years coming, you know?
Right.
All right, but I guess just going back to the Federal Reserve, and I think it's always interesting to go back to the history. I mean, we'll be celebrating the 100th anniversary coming up here soon. I think in December was when it was voted in Congress in 1912, I believe.
Yeah, I think I'm going to drink myself to oblivion on that day.
Good thing. Awesome.
No, but seriously, I think we should celebrate it in some way. What do you think we should do?
Yeah, dude, it's a counterculture anti-Fed day. What could we do? Well, burning notes is something that's really interesting. You know, a lot of people do that, burning Federal Reserve notes. I don't know if you saw. I know you saw the picture. I went to a restaurant with my girlfriend Melanie in Sarasota, and there it was awesome. It was an entire restaurant where American bills, you know, $1 bills, are defaced. People's names on it. They wrote messages, and these things are plastered all over the walls in
wow.
photo frames, hanging from the ceiling. It was awesome.
But was it in the spirit of criticism, or it just like a fun kind of thing?
No, it was a fun thing, but I guess I could sort of interpret it as a huge criticism. But, you know, obviously, I don't think they're making any sort of political statement at all with that.
Yeah, I mean, it is at some level a reflection that the dollar has lost its value, right? If the dollar was more valuable, then people probably wouldn't be leaving them on walls and restaurants.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I actually just drove back. I drove past this little tiny place. Is it in South Carolina? Or is it in Georgia? Hold on. Jekyll Island. Let me just make it up here. Ah, off the coast of Georgia. So Jekyll Island is a small, tiny island where, in 1912, you had a grand meeting of the chief financiers of the day. You had J.P. Morgan on hand. You had a couple of people who worked in the Treasury Department, other big banker names. Well, let me put it up. I mean, I've written about this before, and I think it's something that's sort of lost to history. And at this meeting was where they sat down and actually wrote the Federal Reserve Act, where they created the Federal Reserve. And I know, what's his name there? George G. Griffin. What's his name there? Hold on. All right, some guy named Griffin, whatever. He wrote the book on it called The Creatures from Jekyll Island, talking about the Federal Reserve and how it was created. and G. Edward Griffin is his name, sorry. But you had Senator Nelson Aldrich. He was Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury. Henry Davidson, senior partner of J.P. Morgan. Actually, J.P. Morgan was there. You have Benjamin Strong. You have Paul Warburg, all these big bankers. They show up and they actually write the bill. And then it gets passed, you know, later that year, signed by Woodrow Wilson. And then you have, for the third time in our nation's history, an officially federally sanctioned central bank used to loan money to institutions or to people or to, as we see it, play favorites, increase the money supply at will. So that's sort of the small version of what the Federal Reserve is, and of course created by elite bankers for elite bankers, in secret done. It is the definition of a conspiracy. People gathered on Jekyll Island in Georgia, writing the Federal Reserve Act, and now, 100 years later, we are seeing the total effects, and this is an argument that was not really had. I mean, nobody has really talked about looking at the Federal Reserve as a cause, as a reason for whether it be depressions or unemployment or perpetual loss of income or wealth. Nobody has really done that. Is that right, Sir Christopher Redfield?
I mean, it's not right to the extent that the Austrians have been talking about that. Austrians think that the Federal Reserve is basically responsible for business cycles. Mm-hmm. And business cycles being, you know, terms of unemployment and recession and boom. So the Austrians have been talking about the Federal Reserve as the cause.
Mm-hmm. And these by Austrians, you mean F.A. Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, the early version of, you know, Murray Rothbard, you know, these types who have become the main, I guess I would say, the main fathers of the so-called Austrian economic movement.
And it's right, actually the Austrian school.
Yeah,
the Austrian school. There are contemporaries that are talking about that now, such as Tom Woods. I don't think Jeffrey Tucker is an economist, but I know that he makes arguments. Roderick Long, Robert Murphy, of course. And these are contemporaries that make similar arguments.
Yeah, definitely. And I think now we just had a huge victory. You had Ron Paul's audit the Federal Reserve bill. This wouldn't end it, but rather just require it to keep its books up to date, which seems like a rudimentary request that would be
asked of
anyone.
Yeah, it seems pretty reasonable.
Of course. Yeah, just come on. Just write down where you guys spend your money. That's all. Just include your receipts to Burger King when you guys go out to eat.
Exactly.
And this bill will now, it hasn't been signed by anyone yet. It still hasn't been taken up in the Senate. But it was passed by the House overwhelmingly to audit the Federal Reserve. And what did we see happen in the Senate? It was blocked. It will not come to the floor because of whom?
Well, Harry Reid, the leadership in the Senate, has decided to not bring it to vote.
And why is that?
That's an interesting question. It's ironic that someone who introduced a bill to audit the Fed in 1989 during George Bush administration is now and who spoke again about it on the floor of the Senate in 1995, showing support for auditing the Fed. Now, once the bill has been passed in the House, and now that Harry Reid is actually part of the leadership in the Senate, which began in 1999, he is suddenly, not so suddenly, but he is now opposed to bringing it to vote. And it seems to be a combination of him now being in the leadership, there being a Democrat in the White House, and that he was showed up by a congressman from Texas who hasn't passed a damn bill in who knows how long, and it passed in the House overwhelmingly. So I feel like it's a combination of those three things.
Cool. And here's Ron Paul on the floor If I can skip this advertisement. No, that's the way it goes. Always a stupid rollover. Here's Ron Paul on the floor, just introducing his bill, talking to the people about it.
To yield time to the author of this bill, the gentleman from Texas, the man who understands that not knowing should never be an answer, Mr. Paul.
Wait, first off, before we go on, what does that comment mean?
What does that mean? Interesting. I would say that maybe it's some kind of allusion to Hayek's knowledge problem, calculation problem, but that's just me thinking about that because that's what I think about often.
It's just weird that ISA would say this. ISA's a very powerful member of the House. He sits on the oversight committee, been talking about Fast and Furious and all these things. I just found it interesting, so we'll play the rest here.
Gentlemen from... I thank the gentleman for yielding. I rise, obviously, in strong support of this legislation. I don't know how anybody could be against transparency, and they want secrecy, especially when the secrecy is to protect individuals who deal in trillions of dollars, much bigger than what the Congress does. And these trillions of dollars bail out all the wealthy, rich people, the banks and the big corporations, international, overseas banks, bailing out Europe, dealing with central banks around the Europe, around Europe and different places. And to say that we should have secrecy and say that it's political to have transparency, well, it's very political when you have a Federal Reserve that can bail out one company and not another company. That's pretty political. I think when people talk about independence and having this privacy of the central bank means they want secrecy. And secrecy is not good. We should have privacy for the individual, but we should have openness of government all the time. And we've drifted a long way from that. The bill essentially removes the prohibitions against a full audit. To audit, we should know what kind of transactions are. We should know about the deals that they made when they were fixing the price of LIBOR. These are the kind of things that have gone on for years and we have no access to. So Congress has this responsibility. We're reneging on our responsibility.
Reneging.
We have the responsibility and we have not done it. So it is up to us to reassert ourselves. The Constitution is very clear who has the responsibility, but the law conflicts with the Constitution. The law comes along and says the Congress can't do it. Well, you can't change the Constitution, prohibit the Congress from finding out what's going on by writing a law. And this is what has happened. So it is time that we repeal this prohibition against the full audit of the Federal Reserve. We deserve it. The American people deserve it. The American people know about it and understand it. And that's what they're asking for. They're sick and tired of what happened in the bailout and where the wealthy got bailed out and the poor lost their jobs and they lost their homes. And I yield back.
The gentleman's time has expired. Wow. Yeah, I mean, he's not going to make many more floor speeches, man.
It's a shame.
I know. So I guess you wanted to bring it around. You're talking about Harriet Reid, how it won't be taken up in the Senate. It seems as if we have a little clip of Senator Reid talking on the Senate floor in 1995, as you stated earlier. You want to listen in on what he's saying there if we step into the time machine?
Let's do it.
Would like to extend my congratulations to the senator from North Dakota.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Of course, for authoring this amendment, which I am a sponsor, but more importantly, for speaking out about the Federal Reserve.
Oh.
For years, I have sponsored legislation that would call for an audit of the Federal Reserve System. I offer that amendment every year. Every year, the legislation gets nowhere. I think it would be interesting to know about the Federal Reserve. I think we should audit the Federal Reserve. It's taxpayers' money that's being used there, but we don't do that.
Okay, that's enough. You heard the point. Obviously, this directly contradicts what he's doing today. And, Sir Redfield, what do you think of this hypocrisy?
I'm just kind of taken aback a bit by his delivery. He seems very sincere. His tone is slow and methodical. He's thought about it. He feels it in his heart. I'm convinced. I think he wants a federal audit.
Nah, man. I think really what happened is this happened in 1995. He was very sincere. Then when the Democrats sort of started getting more powerful and they knew they were going to get the majority, somebody sat this guy down and set him straight. They said, if you want to have power in Washington, you better pipe up about Federal Reserve. What do you think?
That's very possible.
No, what do you mean, man? This stuff happens all the time. I don't doubt it. Maybe I'm much more conspiratorially minded there, but I totally think somebody sat this guy down and said, do not push this issue further if you want your career to go places. I mean, that's why Ron Paul is just, you know, he can do whatever he wants. He doesn't care.
I mean, that's the great thing about Ron Paul, right? Because he doesn't care about his political career. He's never really had leadership. I mean, he has, after all this time, he does have a committee that he has to himself.
Yeah, which is basically an Austrian economics committee, right? It's an Austrian economics lesson, if anything.
Right.
I mean, obviously they're boring because they take place in the House. It's not, if you listen to a lecture, it's more interesting. But it at least the language is being talked about. I think it's interesting. That's a good clip. I'm glad that people, especially the internet, they turned around that video so quickly. To me, it was awesome.
The Harry Reid video, that was a very quick turnaround, yeah.
Good God. I mean, this is getting awesome. This is why I love just the grassroots nature. It was obviously some dude who, I don't know, maybe he was Googling around or he had, you know, something already saved and saw that the bill was going forth and Harry Reid wasn't going to introduce it and is like, dude, I have the C-SPAN clip right here.
Right. I would love to see the one from 1989. I can only expect that it would be more passionate.
Oh, yeah.
And more sincere.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I think we have C-SPAN all the way back then. I mean, we could go take a look at the archives. It's been a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, we can do that. Yeah. You have to show me. You're more investigatively inclined.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an idea. All right, so talked about economics, about that. Also, very related to this, you have... I just read this article in the Wall Street Journal, I think two or three days ago. I had it at the hotel in Tallahassee. It seems as if the Justice Department will not be seeking any charges against Goldman Sachs or any of its employees for financial fraud related to the mortgage crisis. So they said, the Justice Department said there was no burden of proof that could be met in order to prosecute Goldman, this is quoting from the article, criminally, based on claims made in an extensive report prepared by a U.S. Senate panel that investigated the financial crisis. Thoughts?
Right, so this kind of brings me back to a pop culture reference again, where Chappelle shows that the way that drug dealers are treated and the way that bankers are kind of treated by the system. So there's a difference in the way that if a banker was going to be charged with some kind of crime, they give him a call and they politely ask him to come in for questioning, as opposed to breaking down doors and violating like their wife or something.
God, man, you have to bring it to that. Jeez.
Have you not seen this Chappelle clip?
Which one is it?
This is the one where the roles are kind of... So Chappelle switches the roles. He takes an example of how a black drug dealer is treated by the police when police want to charge him, as opposed to like a financial head, a white financial head, and the way that the police deal with him when they want to charge him.
Okay.
Well, but I'm sorry. This is off topic. That was something that reminded me of. But there are few other institutions on earth that have as much power and political clout, or I should just term it, have as much political capital as Goldman Sachs. So it's really no wonder that they going to be charged or there's not going to be any kind of serious investigation led against them.
No, I mean, I think if you look at everything going on right now in Europe and the Eurozone, is sort of the same thing. The tentacles of Goldman Sachs, Mario Monti, who is the undemocratic prime minister who was just installed, technocratic, sort of coup d'etat thrown in by the European Commission, which is totally, if we're actually thinking about democratic institutions and trying to uphold those standards, the European Commission is probably one of the most evil institutions that's ever existed in the history of the world. They deposed a sitting prime minister, pressured him to leave. I mean, you're talking about a huge country, man. You're talking about a country with some upwards of like 62 million people, and their leader was just thrown out by a group of like 30 people because they didn't like him.
Yeah, I mean, corporations have an enormous amount of power, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just the case that the way that these these governmental institutions are set up, corporations are incented to go after, to accumulate political capital, because this protects them. This protects them in the long run. Protects them from lawsuits. Allows them to take to have advantages that their competitors don't have. It allows them to craft legislation or amend legislation in a way that would disproportionately...
Wait. So what are you saying?
So maybe an easy way of thinking about this is that taxpayer money is like cookies in a cookie jar. Or tax or legislation is like cookies in a cookie jar. And governments hold the ability to open up jars and give out cookies. And the more capital that you have, the more access to cookies you have. So it only makes sense that businesses compete for the accumulation of political capital and make investments away from production in order to get these government cookies, if you will.
I like that. You should sell that. You should put that on a T-shirt. Stop! Move away from the cookie jar.
This kind of brings me to one of my passions and one of these areas of study that I'm currently pursuing, and that's this idea, this public choice theory idea, which is, it's kind of a way economists have imposed their, even encroached on the discipline of political science. And this has been happening since the 70s, since James Buchanan and Gordon Pollack, calculus of consent. Calculus of consent. They went out to win a Nobel Prize in economics, and since then, the field of political science has been changed. Political scientists themselves have to study economics in a way so that they can analyze political actors and government institutions themselves through this lens. And in short, I've heard public choice theory described in two ways. One is that take the romanticism out of politics. So when you're in love with someone, they can kind of do no wrong, and they can hurt you again and again, and you keep going back. And public choice theory says that this is not the way that we should view government, and we should apply the same standards that we apply to businesses to governments, kind of. So okay, that's one way of thinking about it. And then another way is that, so that's on the institutional level. And then another way, if we bring it down to the individual level, is that we have to stop looking at people in two different ways. We have to end this bifurcation of human nature. Humans respond to incentives, and whether they be individuals that are acting in the market or individuals that are acting in the government sector, providing government goods and services, they're both going to respond to incentives. And we have to recognize this in order to make some kind of rational analysis of the way that they act.
Okay. Huh. Well, I guess this is sort of something that you whatever the news event is, or you know, things come out about, you know, I don't understand, like rappers, people have the incentive to pursue different aspects, and I guess you can see it in popular culture everywhere, right? How do you apply that?
Yeah, I definitely apply it to popular culture. Maybe a story that came out recently that Democracy Now! Just a couple of days ago is that a study came out that showed companies were changing their production processes in a way that would make them produce more pollution. So it's certain pollution that government has kind of when you produce this particular type, you are eligible for.
Okay. Yeah. You get certain credits. Carbon credits, right?
Exactly. You're eligible for certain carbon credits. So businesses have changed their production in order to go after these carbon credits, and then sell those carbon credits to other companies who produce in a different way, who produce their in a different way, right? So businesses that weren't engaging this type of carbon production switched their production process because the sale of carbon credits were more profitable than what they were doing with that production capacity.
Huh.
And this is a perversion. This is a market perversion.
Yeah.
And this can be predicted by public choice. We would expect that businesses would abandon the processes that they were engaging in order to pursue a more profitable process.
Yeah.
Regardless if that's a reflection of actual market demand or some kind of legislation that government enacted.
So it's like, Bill, let's pump out the CO2. And then you just change all the machines, mechanisms, and then they're just pumping it out in order to get more credits, so then they can go to the market and actually exchange it. And it becomes a lucrative market in the end. And I guess you could, in this instance, once again say that the road to hell is paved with beautiful and great intentions.
Right. I think that's a good way of thinking about it.
Man, that's why it comes out again and again. It's as if the more power, and I think that's the argument going back to my theme of arguing with conservatives, the more and more that we give the government power to have a voice in anything, whether it be, you know, how zippers should be zipped up, to how you import your tea, to what standards of, you know, I don't know, censorship you should have on the television for your children. As soon as you do that, like you said before, you create these incentives that will always, in the end, not bring you what was first intention. It'd be terrible consequences. I think you bring up a good point.
Right. So for my attitude of skepticism, we don't know for certain that an incentive that government creates will necessarily have terrible results. We just know that there will be maybe unintended consequences, and we know that they can be unpredictable, right? We can predict some of them, but we can't predict maybe the longer term ones. And
yeah,
it could be the case that government create some kind of legislation that has a net positive effect that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Okay.
I can't think of any examples. I don't know if there are any.
Well, I mean, if you take the bigger one you're talking about, is any sort of military intervention by the government. I mean, I love when people talk to me about 9/11 and they assume that history began on 9/11. You know, and I think for me, I've had the biggest trouble in just trying to argue with people is that 9/11 did not just happen. It's not just that people decided one day that they hated America and to fly planes into the building. If they really hated America, if they really hated our culture, they would have slammed planes into, you know, Hollywood or something.
I think that's true. But your point is well taken. It's an ignorance of history, of America's intervention in the Middle East in the past. It's as if September 10th happened. We weren't, like, we were just minding our own business, and radicals in the Middle East were upset that we were minding our business. So they decided to crash planes into the World Trade Center on September 11th, which is absurd.
Definitely. All right, well, cool. We're getting here in the final segments. You got some more good news for me? We've done a pretty good news show so far. I like that.
I think I'm all out of good stories. I'm all I'm all out of the optimism for today.
No. Oh, man. Well, so it goes. Well, we got a lot of good stories, a lot of good reporting here. It's been fun. You're a man who is very noteworthy. You know how to parse the issues well. Thanks. For joining me there, Sir Redfield.
No, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and we'll see if we can get you back on. As for everyone else, this has been Liberty in Exile. I'm your host, Yael Osofsky, reporting from the Sovereign Southern Studio. Here we are. It's been another great show. Off we are. Au revoir. Et bonne chance. À tous.